back, pulls up the three, boom, knocks it down. Curry from the corner at three, puts it in.
For overtime, makes it, Garrett, Murray.
Welcome to the MVP cast from me, Mark Woods. My guest is back in the British Basketball League this season after a couple of years away, taking over a club that was a little bit fractured behind the scenes last term, now piecing it back together, hoping for somewhat greater stability this year. The new head coach of Worcester Wolves, Matt Newby, joins us. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on the podcast.
I mean, it's been a couple of years out. Is it... What's the reinvigoration factor about coming into a new club, new team, new situation?
I think, the Worcester opportunity came up and obviously expressed my interest and took the interview. And I think it was just the way the management put the proposal forward. It was essentially a fresh start, a new opportunity. And, you know, Worcester's got a strong pedigree over its time in the BBL, and I think I'd like to help elevate the program again.
Coming from out of the experience of Leeds Force, where it was a long, slow build up, then moving into the BBL, and you had that good season when Craver Knutson was there, and you're making the playoffs, but it wasn't title challenges there. Is it nice to go in somewhere where I guess, from past experience, not last season, but before that, there is a level of expectation of doing well over a season?
Yeah, I think pressure is a privilege, isn't it? If you're given an opportunity like this, you've got to take it. For me, the Leeds thing was definitely a project of passion, and we put our all into that, and it went as far as it could go, here. I think there's a similar heritage. Mick Donovan has driven the program since its inception. The university's behind it. There's a very strong and passionate fan base in Worcester, and I like that. And I think moving forward, it's a good thing to have that pressure there.
Does it feel like have you sort of, I guess, noticed that early? Because even last season, the one thing that was struck me about Worcester, I mean, the team wasn't doing well. There was a lot of turmoil. But fans came week after week after week to keep supporting the team. And how much does it help to go to a place where people do seem to care?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that runs throughout the whole organisation. The one thing I've learned coming here is there's a lot of people that are fully vested in the project and the program, and the legacy that it's left over the past few years, and when you walk in the gym, there is a high expectancy from the fan, but the genuine people with a genuine passion for the sport and a genuine love of the game, and they're fully vested in the players, the coach, and the identity of the club.
When you had those couple of years out, I mean, obviously you were still involved with the City of Leeds Foundation and the Academy and the university program, I guess, there as well. But was there anything you did in that period of time to, I guess, prepare yourself better for the challenge of once again, at some point, coming back and being a head coach in a professional level?
I've just kept my professional development going. I'd spent a lot of time with the Leeds program, dedicated to multiple tiers of the program, which was often tiring and a bit stressful at times. But it gave me the opportunity to access different coaches at different levels. You can always ask a question of yourself with the people that you're working with, and also it gave me the opportunity to kind of stretch my legs and go abroad. I spent a little bit of time in Serbia with a partnership that the Leeds program have with Red Star Belgrade, and it was just an opportunity to go and learn more, test your credentials essentially and challenge your own beliefs and philosophies.
What do you find out when you go to somewhere like Red Star with the pedigree that they've got, the development system that they've had for years and years and years? How do you kind of go in there and consciously try to soak something up?
Well, I think it's, you know, you've got to put yourself in a position to learn. I've always been a big believer in, I guess the way I grew up was going to try and find the best resources or sources for information and coaching. I'd spent a lot of time in my early sort of development going out to the US, and when I kind of looked east, Serbia is obviously a natural one. They consistently produce high level players, high level coaches. You know, the European leagues are littered with a strong influence from not just Serbia but the Balkan region, and I just wanted to learn. So, you know, when you've got access to witness the youth team coaches' work or the senior coaches' work, you just make sure you you access it, and it's about probably interrogating your own qualities, your own standards, your own philosophy, and also capturing what makes them successful.
What, if anything, were you able to pick from what you saw there that you thought, I can realistically, with the resources I've got, the system we've got, that I can bring back and put that into my system and make it better?
Well, I think, you know, the one thing there is the volume and intensity of practice, the quality of teaching, the fact that they do challenge one another as coaches, that the fraternity is strong by virtue of competition, not just on the court, but in terms of the professional development of the coaches and those around the sport. And I mean, you've witnessed it yourself when you've been away to Europe and around the world. You know, the best environments, you're challenged, and you're challenging someone else or being challenged by others.
So your players can expect to run much harder in practice this season than they would have done at Leeds.
No. I mean, I think, you know, it's all right being a taskmaster, and I think the volume of practice and the intensity of practice has to be married with a quality of teaching and a broader comprehension of the game, you know.
How much with the team that you've got do you expect to spend time teaching this season as opposed to actually sort of coaching and getting ready for games? I mean, do you sort of sense early on what that sort of pendulum will feel like over the course of a season?
I think you probably touched on it. I think it's different season to season. You obviously recruit a team with an idea, hopefully you go after players that are going to fit your philosophy or your identity, and ultimately you've got to identify whether or not you've been on the money, or you've got to be a bit more fluid in your coaching and your teaching to get the best outcomes and results. You know, I think any coach in the league will tell you, you know, the players walk through the door on the first day, and you can be pleasantly surprised, or you might question a couple of decisions that you made, but you've got to make it work. I'm really happy with the recruitment that we've done, and I think you know, looking at it from having a blank canvas, I think we'll be competitive, and I hope to forge a new identity for the program.
What's your scouting process or preparation process, if you could talk us through it? Because obviously a lot of coaches will watch, you know, as much game tape, which will be much simpler this season because almost every game's on YouTube. A lot of coaches use the Synergy stat system, which, yeah, for those who don't know, it gives you lots of clips of games, lots of different breakdowns of players. What's your sort of process of preparing for that next opponent or sets of opponents?
Well, I think the synergy is a massive advantage to the coaches. You need the time, obviously, to get the highest returns out of it. But ultimately, what we will do in terms of breaking down our next opponents, it would be to look at the individual profile of the team. So the strengths and weaknesses, tendencies of the individuals. Look at the systems that they employ offensively and defensively, and look at how to approach that. You know, if they defend pick and rolls a certain way, or they have a specific scheme defensively that we need to adjust to, then that would be a big emphasis. And then offensively, how they look to exploit other teams, what are their tendencies as a five-man unit, you know, how successful are they in certain situations, look at how maybe other teams have obviously played them, and where other teams have had success defending them and obviously attacking them, because you can learn a lot from the respective matchups in the league and get a better game plan by doing so.
Do you spend a lot of time watching game film? I mean, is that as big a thing, or does it tend to be for you a lot more concentrated on very specific things that you need?
I mean, at different times in the season, you know, you'll have a lot more time to break things down. At other times, you know, when those games come really, really frequently, you might be looking to try and fix a couple of smaller issues to make sure that you're ready for the next one. You know, there'll be times in the season where you'll catch probably 4 games in 8 to 10 days, just because by virtue of the way the schedule's put together. So sometimes you've got to just, like you say, focus on certain things that are going to benefit you in the short term. But over time, what you should be looking to do is holding your team to account with regards to how we're performing defensively and offensively, showing them the mistakes, and ideally fixing the problems on the floor having done that.
I mean, you're a coach educator, have been as well as a coach. And how does that evolution now change? Because obviously there's the X and O side, there's the man or woman management side of coaching, but how do you integrate the technological side of coaching, which has become such a big part of the strategic makeup of that role?
I mean, anyone that knows me, I need a bit of help sometimes with the technology side of things. I'm not going to lie to you, but I mean, with the trends that have come in over the probably the last 5 years, certainly you've got a lot of access to you've got access to a lot of information, and I think the key is making it real to the player. You know, you can capture a lot of statistical evidence, you can capture a lot of film. You know, you could spend hours and hours on one individual or several phases of play if you wanted to. You can go into that much depth. I think it's making it relevant to your players, making it relevant to the team, and presenting them with solutions based on that information, and being able to articulate it, because there's a lot of people that are very, very good with the technology but can't necessarily translate it for the player or for the team. And I think I'm seeing that it's going to be very important down the line with all these trends to be able to pick from the respective resources and be able to present it in a way that the team can take it and run with it.
Your roster that you've built this season, obviously very, very new, and that's an incredible sort of challenge in itself to bring those new guys together. But you pick a couple of players like Kofi Josephs coming in, who's bounced over the place, has had different opportunities. How do you take someone like him and not necessarily build a team around him, but build a team that can get the best out of him?
Well, ultimately, Kofi has a very good offensive skill set. I think that's well documented. For me, the attraction was that he's a domestic guy. He's got a credible resume, and you're right. It's not about building a system around one individual, but making it an opportunity where he can be successful. That's a build over time. It's we've got 9 to 10 new players in the roster. We've got to find out about their personalities, their identities, and make sure they mesh and also help them understand one another's skill sets. And then for me, it's my responsibility to put a tactical scheme on the floor that enhances their strengths and, develops, well, strengthens them in other areas, in the areas that they need to develop.
And you've got someone like Cordis Edwards, comes in, went to Southern Mississippi. I mean, when you're looking at guys like that who, nice resumes coming out of college, we never know quite how they translate into the professional ranks, but what's the process that a club like Worcester goes about to get someone like him?
Well, I mean, the management were very, very good in terms of they gave me the opportunity to go out and recruit a team without too many influences. You know, it's been a good opportunity for me, and the way I spend my time is not different to probably the other coaches in the league. It's a lot of phone calls. It's a lot of film. It's a lot of referencing the players and trying to understand, well, as best you can, how it might translate. You know, someone like Cortez Edwards, he's, you know, averaged 13-6-4-2 in a very, very strong conference in the NCAA. You know, he has the DNA to be suitable in our league, which is quite up tempo. You know, it's an athletic league in a lot of ways, and one that's one where the game's played at pace. And I think he suited that, so it was a natural choice amongst a number of resumes to hard target him.
But it's interesting you talk about the freedom to recruit. I mean, that's not something that head coaches in Worcester have always had. Was that one of the appeals to you, maybe, that might not have been there before, that there is some latitude now, it seems, for the head coach to put his team on the floor rather than putting someone else's team on the floor?
I mean, I can't really speak about other tenures. You know, I don't know what's gone by in the past or how things have been managed. All I know is that the management have been really, really supportive, and I think it always gives you a positive mindset when somebody entrusts you with those responsibilities. And I have to say that the management were very, very good, and they said, look, you need to go out and find what you want on the floor, and I've been able to do that.
Let's just take a pause for one moment to tell you all about the British Basketball All-Stars Championship, which returns on Sunday, October the 13th. The venue, the Copper Box Arena in London, with eight of the BBL's very best teams doing battle in this fantastic tournament, which will be live on Sky Sports. It features 12-minute games, an all-star five-point line, and that golden buzzer power play. And the British Basketball All-Stars Championship promises to be a non-stop afternoon of fast-paced hoops action. Now, the tournament, again, showcasing the very best of British basketball talent, Surrey Scorchers, out to defend the title they won 12 months ago. You really want to be there. You can get your tickets now. They're on sale with all the information available at allstarsbasketball.co.uk. Matt Newby's our guest. Matt, you've had a quite... I wouldn't say broad coaching journey. You've coached at every single level possibly imaginable since you started out this year, under 16, your college programs, professional programs, and the full shebang. But what made you want to be a coach?
Honestly, it's a very good question. I had always been heavily involved in sport at high school and in FE, and ultimately, I love basketball, but I was conscious that my level of play wasn't perhaps where it could be to get a return of it and return from it in the future. So, I made some choices in terms of education to go down the sports studies coaching route, and really enjoyed it. I loved working in the community. I loved working with teams. Seeing young people succeed was kind of a big deal to me, and sport's an excellent vehicle for that. So that's kind of how it got started. And then the right things happened at the right time on the most part. And I was fortunate enough to take a nice journey in terms of junior national league coaching and then senior coaching.
What was the point where you, because obviously lots of people do under 16 coaching and it's something you do on a Thursday night or a Saturday afternoon. But what was the point when you sort of thought, yeah, I can make a career of this, and I want to make a career of this?
I mean, it's not difficult. I say you need to make your own luck and have a little bit of luck on top of that. I think I came out of university with a coaching degree, but that doesn't guarantee you a job in this country. You know what I mean? So normally the route takes several paths. You know, it might be you get into community development, and then you can forge links with a program. And basically, I'd come back to Leeds, started working heavily in the community and with schools in the area, and some jobs came up that kind of led me down the path. You know, I was fortunate enough that a partnership was being forged between one of the SSPs in Leeds and Leeds Carnegie University, and I applied for the role, and then it kind of went from there. It gave me the opportunity to go into senior coaching while still maintaining a strong influence on what was happening in the community, and then the program built from there.
How fun was it to see that though grow so organically, especially when you're eventually able to put the professional team on top of it? Because emotionally, that must have been quite special to have been able to shape it in the way that you did.
Yeah, it was. You know, whenever you invest in something, you hope to get return on it, right? And ultimately, we, from 2006 till 2014, we travelled up the ranks. There'd been some really significant successes, and then the entry to the BBL gave us kind of the cherry on the cake, if you want to use that analogy. And it was great. We rolled the ball out against programs and teams that I'd, you know, seen in my youth, and that was kind of a big deal.
How tough is that though on the flip side, because you're effectively a co-owner of the club, you're effectively running it as a director of basketball, and you're the head coach? And how tough was, or was that more tough than you could have imagined, to kind of have a professional team on top of everything else that you were doing? Because I remember at the time talking to you a few times and you were like, my life is crammed and there is not a spare second here available.
Yeah, that's the flip side of it, isn't it? I think, you know, sometimes you can put yourself in the position where you were doing too much, but it was exciting at the time, and you know, there was still some steps to make to continue to drive it forward, and therefore at the time I believe that was worth it, you know.
After 10 years of it though, how much was it a wrench when that journey ended at the Force?
Tough, yeah. You know, these things, you know, come to test you. Unfortunately, there was a chain of events that led me to be no longer at the helm and no longer involved, and that was tough. And ultimately, I had to go in a different direction. It allowed me to refocus my energies on some other aspects of the program and the community in Leeds, and it gave me an opportunity to evaluate the what next.
And your family got you back a little bit as well, though. That was the flip side.
Yeah. Well, no, I've got obviously two girls, and my partner Jess is incredibly supportive. They were brilliant. You know, both my girls started playing actually in that time, so that was very cool. And you're right, I got to go out for dinner a little bit.
When you saw what happened with Leeds, I mean, you had that sort of terrible final year where, you know, the club was bought over, and it really ran into the ground, and, you know, and that's probably being kind of it. Was there part of you that felt a bit pained at seeing things end the way that it did?
No, nobody wants to see that. Nobody wants to see that, for not just from on a personal level, but from a, you know, from a basketball landscape point of view. However it played out, I wasn't happy. You know, nobody can take joy in seeing a team fold, and you know, the impact of that, I think, unfortunately, will still be there for a little while.
I mean, still having such close ties to Leeds and basketball there, I mean, it's such a big city. You want a professional team in that city. If you were doing it again, or someone else was coming back in, what do you think's the one thing that would need to change?
That's a big question. That's a really big question. I think, you know, the basketball landscape in the country is in shift constantly at the moment. If somebody was going to, in any city, you know, you could say Liverpool, you could say, you could say Leeds, or you could pick another major city. I think you've got to be very, very mindful of the investment it requires, what you need underpinning it, and the human resource that you require to make it function both on and off the floor. You know, there's a couple of cities I think in the country that could sustain a new basketball franchise, but you've got to have the right people at the right time, and the right infrastructure, and the, you know, the programs that have survived the big highs and the big lows in the BBL, like the Newcastles and the Leicesters, they've got that right. You know, they've got the on court and the off court down really, really well.
We always talked about trying to get that arena built in Leeds for the team. I mean, was that, do you think that would be a reasonable proposition in the future, or was it something that you just thought, I don't think we can pull this off?
I mean, at the time, you know, there was a couple of people involved, and there was some very strong conversations going on with important decision makers within the city. So I think it was always an aspiration to do so. I think it's still an aspiration of the city to have a sporting venue. Whether or not that's something that would host a franchise, I'm uncertain. But I think ultimately the way that other programs in the country have approached it, once they've got their own venue, they're in a lot better shape, and they have a home for their respective club.
Let's flip this around to something else you do. You've been very involved in the 3-on-3 basketball through sort of Basketball England's program, and for a lot of people, that's been something that's been very neglected. I mean, there was an Olympic place that was sort of up for grabs that no one really seemed to do anything about. And, you know, the Commonwealth Games in a few years' time in Birmingham will have 3-on-3. But it's an aspect of basketball that hasn't seen a lot of resources and attention given to. What, from being involved in it, what's the potential, and what do you think could be done to kind of make this country a 3-on-3 country?
Well, I mean, the 3-on-3 that I was involved in was actually the first kind of world championship. I think they framed it as in Greece, and from there it's just snowballed. You know, I think the format's good. It's exciting. I think originally they kind of looked at how volleyball had reinvented itself with the 2-on-2 aspect, and it works for basketball as well. It's up tempo. It's fast. It's something that can be replicated on any court. And I can't answer any questions on why maybe we haven't jumped on this format, because I think it would work for the UK. But obviously, there's a lot for the governing body to attend to. There's a lot for GB basketball to attend to. But I think it could be a format where we could get some. I don't want to say cheap wins, but, you know, easy wins, because, you know, it lends itself to smaller countries. You know, if you put the right profile of team together, you can be very, very successful. The French have invested in it heavily. I know a few people within the governing body there, and they invested heavily in it from an early start, and they've been very successful across all categories. And I think it's a way of promoting the sport in a new way. The European tour, the world tour, you've seen a different type of player maybe seeing success on the floor as well. So it's exciting times for it. I hope there's an opportunity when I guess the governing body and GB basketball have managed to manage other aspects of the national team's profile to look at it and potentially invest in it. Certainly with the Commonwealth coming round as well.
I mean, from what you've seen of, you know, from what other countries and world champs etc. I mean, do you think that, as you talk about it, it's a different kind of profile of player that you would recruit for a 3-on team. But do you see that this country has that kind of player and the quality of player that we could succeed?
I think so. But I mean, they need to adjust to the format. I think if you look at how the, again, how the French have selected, they're not, it's not all the same players that are rolling out in national teams. They, you know, I think you need a blend of athleticism and strength, but you see a very sharp basketball IQ. It's an interesting format that lends itself to a certain type of player in a sense, and it's exciting.
So pick a 3-on-3 dream 3-on-3 team in the BBL.
Oh, I don't know if I could do that right now. I'm either going to put noses out of joint, or I'm going to have to save that one for another day.
We'll come back to that later in the season.
Yeah.
Last couple of things. I mean, obviously your role at Worcester, head coach of Wolves, but also you've got a role within the university and the basketball pathway there. What in practical terms will that involve?
Well, my understanding is that I've come in obviously to direct to manage the BBL program in the first instance, but I think again the management have been very, very good in terms of affording me the opportunity to begin to work with the staff that they have here in the books program and the staff that they have in the broader basketball community here to kind of forge a little bit of a new look. Worcester was a perennial title holder in the books. When I was at Leeds, we matched up with them every year, and I think there's very much a desire and a passion to return to compete with the guys that are at the top at the moment. And I think one of my responsibilities will be helping the coaching staff of the respective books programs continue to move forward on top of the great work that they've done.
And given all that, will you get any time off this season?
I hope so. I hope so. But you know what? It's a great opportunity in a great town and with a great basketball community. And I'm really thankful for the opportunity that Mick Donovan and the management have given me.
And this weekend, I should say, away at Bristol Flowers Cup, local derby. I mean, it'd be nice to sort of feel that back in that passionate sort of environment again, where, early in the season, okay, it's cup and it's group stages, etc. But, you kind of have that little frisson that maybe you didn't have the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, Andreas builds great teams and we've already matched up with them in pre-season. And it was a 1-point game at the end, and I think both of us were still getting to know our teams and the teams getting to know themselves. Although he's returned a nice core at the Flyers, I think they're athletic, they're strong, very, very physical, defend very, very well. And Andreas has got a nice blueprint in terms of his offensive scheme. So I think it'll be a great matchup and an exciting test for us. And like you say, it's a local rivalry, so the fans will be into it as well.
You'll be hoping to throw them to the wolves, as they say. Well, it's really great to see you back in the BBL this season. It's been too long. Best of luck for this campaign, Matt, and thank you for coming on and joining us.
Thank you very much, Mark.
That's it for this edition of the MVP Cast. You can subscribe via your favourite podcast provider or get all the episodes via mvp247.com. We'll have another one coming very soon. But for now, from me, Mark Woods, it's goodbye.